The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 2, concluded. The times were changing, and they were changing fast. They weren't changing for the Hill Country. The hopes that had been raised there by the creation of the REA had been dashed when the REA announced the minimum requirements for electrification. The REA Act required loans to be self-liquidating. Before a farmer's electrical cooperative could obtain a loan, therefore, the REA had to be satisfied that the cooperative would be able to repay it, together with annual interest of about 3%, within 25 years. The crucial criterion the REA established to ensure this was population density. The agency said it would make no loan in an area in which the electrical lines to be built would serve an average of less than 3 farms per mile. Even so low a figure was dangerous, critics said. Not 3 but 7 customers per mile, 7 good customers, heavy users of electricity, not poor farmers but farmers equipped with electrical appliances, was the bare minimum necessary to repay a 3% loan, they said. And the REA, all too aware that failure to comply with the Act's self-liquidating provision might give congressional conservatives ammunition to use against the agency, would go no lower. Approaching the REA late in 1936, a delegation from the Hill Country was told that the 3-per-mile criterion would not be waived. Even the powerful Congressman Buchanan, intervening on their behalf, had been unable to persuade the new agency. Developments in other parts of Texas proved that the agency was, in fact, determined not to waive the 3-per-mile minimum, even for wealthy ranchers who might be expected to be heavy users of electricity. In one area of West Texas, for example, prosperous ranchers guaranteed the REA a minimum payment of $75 per month per ranch. Their application was turned down on the ground that it could never pay out. The REA would not even consider electrifying areas as sparsely populated as the Hill Country, because it simply could not afford to do so. The REA's first administrator, Morris Cook, had estimated that an investment of $1.5 billion, a figure far beyond the agency's anticipated budget, would be necessary to bring electricity to even 50% of all rural homes within 10 years. As for the rest, of course, there are many farms which cannot be reached for many years. There are farms and neighborhoods too sparsely settled to afford power. Early in 1938, representatives of 5 Hill Country counties, Barnett, Blanco, Llano, Gillespie, and Hayes, who were planning to form a Purdenalis Electric Cooperative, met in Austin with an REA representative, Russell Cook. Cook put it to them straight. "You have too much land and not enough people," says one of the men at the meeting. "He was just very discouraging. He said, 'You want to go lay lines to one of the most remote areas of the whole country? We simply can't do that. It's impossible.'" The words were familiar to the people of the Edwards Plateau. The plateau's implacable geography had always been too strong for men. The distances, the hilly terrain, the lack of rainfall, the rocky sparseness of the limestone soil, these forces, forces over which they had no control, had kept the population small and had condemned them, and their parents and grandparents before them, to isolation and poverty. These factors had kept them from getting a railroad. Why shouldn't these same factors keep them from getting electricity? They'd not been able to persuade even the People's Party, the party which had been spawned on the plateau, to send them lecturers because they were too thinly settled away up here on the Purdenalis River. Why should the New Deal be any different? New Deal programs that had helped farmers in other areas hadn't helped the Hill Country much. More important, perhaps, the New Deal had given other farmers hope. After 5 years of the New Deal, hope in the Hill Country was still in almost as short supply as cash. Why should REA be any different from AAA? And then other words began to be heard in those hills. One of the first men to whom they were spoken was a rancher named E. Babe Smith, who had by coincidence been raised in Lampasas, birthplace of the People's Party, before moving to northeastern Burnett County, an area so isolated that it was known as the Dark Corner of Burnett County. Smith's grandmother had lived there for 55 years and had never during that time visited even once the town of Marble Falls, 40 miles away. In Lampasas, Smith had had electricity, from a diesel engine, from sunset to 10 o'clock every evening, when it wasn't breaking down. And when in 1936 he had heard that the Rural Electrification Administration was organizing a cooperative in Bell County, and that lines would be built to Bartlett, only 40 miles away from his ranch, he had gone to the Bell Cooperative office to see if the lines could be extended into his area. But, he recalls, they said there was just no way I could be served, that we were just too sparsely populated. They said, you're just too thin. They said there was no hope. Smith, a slender man, 6 feet 3 inches tall, a man of considerable determination, he had managed to earn a degree from Southwestern University in Georgetown, was a rancher other ranchers respected. And when the Purdenalis Electric Cooperative was being organized, he was asked to join the Burnett County delegation to the PEC meeting in Johnson City. He refused, however. I said, no sense my going. I've been to Bartlett. No hope for me. His corner was the dark corner. He felt it was going to stay dark. Then Roy Fry, a Burnett druggist and politician, asked Smith to meet with the district's new congressman. The meeting took place in Fry's Rexall drugstore. The three men sat behind the prescription counter, Fry on a stool, Babe Smith and Lyndon Johnson on packing cases. When a customer entered, Fry would interrupt the conversation to wait on him. The Buchanan and Roy Inks dams were almost completed and would be producing power shortly, Johnson told the two men. With REA help, that power could be brought to the dark corner. Smith demurred. The area would never get an REA loan, he said. Johnson replied, I'll get it for you. I'll go to the REA. I'll go to the president if I have to. But we will get the money. On June 20, 1938, the PEC held a second meeting in the courthouse in Johnson City, for county agents and community leaders. Although the 108-mile round trip took 5 hours because there was not a foot of paved road between here and Johnson City, Smith went to this meeting. Lyndon Johnson had inspired me, he says. He had made me feel there was a chance. Despite Johnson's efforts, he'd been talking to other people all over the area just like he had me, Babe Smith says. Only 60 persons came to the PEC meeting. And not all of them were believers, Smith says. The Gillespie County agent, Henry Grote, delivered an angry lecture to the young congressman, telling him that in attempting to obtain electricity for farmers, you're not doing farmers any favor. They would not be able to pay their electric bills, would sink into debt, and would lose their farms. Other men at the meeting were not enthusiastic because of their lack of understanding of electricity's many uses on a farm. A lot just felt it meant the light bulb, and that was all, Smith says, and they weren't sure that that was worth the expense. Even those who were in favor of electricity felt, as Smith felt, that we cannot meet the three to the mile. Standing in front of the judge's bench, Johnson explained that electricity could run farm equipment as well as lights. He said that if lines were laid out carefully, and every person along them was signed up, he believed that a 3-per-mile average could be obtained. Most important, in Smith's words, he inspired everyone with the feeling that there was at least a chance. If you get the people signed up, he told them, he would get the REA loan. And he made us believe it. They agreed to try to get as many signatures as possible, and the REA required $5 deposit on applications for electric service and on easements to allow the REA to string lines across their land. In that sparsely populated area, these signatures had to be obtained the same way votes were obtained, one by one, and they were harder to get than votes. The reluctance of the people sprang from simple poverty. It cost $5, and a lot of people didn't have $5, says Guthrie Taylor, and it sprang from fear. They were afraid of the wires. The idea of electricity, so unknown to them, terrified them. It was the same stuff as lightning. It sounded dangerous. What would happen to a child who put its hand on a wire? And what about their cows, their precious, irreplaceable few cows that represented so much of their total assets? They were so worried, Lucille O'Donnell recalls. They would say, what'll happen if there's a storm? The wires will fall down and kill, electrocute, the cattle. Or they were worried that the wires would attract lightning, which would kill the cattle. Or that the crews that came to repair downed lines would leave the gates open and let their cows loose. They simply could not afford to lose their livestock, Mrs. O'Donnell says. and they were afraid of the papers that they were being asked to sign. The people of the hill country were leery of lawyers. Lawyers meant mortgages and foreclosures. Legal documents, documents they did not understand, turned them skittish. Who knew what hidden traps lay within them? Were they signing something that one day would allow someone to take their land away? In vain, the county agents and community leaders tried to explain to the farmers that they were not being asked to surrender control of their land. Many farmers, as one report put it, had the idea that in signing an easement they were mortgaging their property to the U.S. Treasury. Thousands of easements were required, not only from farmers who wanted electricity, but from farmers who didn't, because the lines had to cross their land, and it was difficult to persuade the farmers to give them. They were afraid of debt, terrified of debt, for in the hill country it was felt that once you went into debt you never got out, that once you went into debt it was only a matter of time before you lost your land. At meetings, Smith recalls, people would say, "How much is it going to cost to run that line to my farm?" $500. "You're not going to convince me that when I sign that application I'm not going to be responsible for that $500. You're not going to convince me that I'm not going to be putting a debt on my farm." I tried to explain to them that this, the Perdinalis Electric Cooperative, was a corporation and that the government was going to look to the corporation to pay back, but they couldn't accept the idea of corporate responsibility. For families so afraid of debt, the minimum monthly charge for the electricity, $2.45 for 25 kilowatts, was also a source of concern. And there was the suspicion, generations old, of a people who felt that they had been victimized by railroads and utilities. The first letter sent out on behalf of the PEC by Secretary-Treasurer Hugo Klappenbach sought to allay those suspicions in a rallying cry that might have been sounded by a lecturer of the Old Farmers' Alliance. "This line is being built by the consumers it serves, and they are the owners," he said. "It will not try to cover up the investments it has either. Management is local people, and does not have to wait for some group of New York financiers to grant permits or concessions. Let's stand together and build our own electric distribution lines, and then have the voice in the control." Creation of the PEC, he said, would free the hill country from dependence on the Northeast. "We may see the opening up of manufacturing interests here, where the raw materials are grown. Why should we continually send our wool to Boston? Why not manufacture it here, or anyway get it ready to spin right here where it's grown?" But many hill country residents could not believe that they would really keep the voice in the control. Lyndon Johnson was sitting on the porch of his cousin Ava's home one afternoon, talking about the PEC, when Ava's husband, Olin Cox, suddenly burst out, "I don't believe it's going to work, Lyndon. The Northerners will pull the strings and buck you down." And the reluctance sprang from ignorance about the potential benefits of the product they were being asked to buy. To many hill country families, electricity meant light bulbs, a benefit to be sure, but not in the view of many a benefit worth risking losing one's farm for. "Something you'd never had or experienced, are you going to miss it?" Babe Smith asks. The county agents and community leaders were not having much success in the sign-up campaign. Babe Smith remembers a meeting in the Kempner schoolhouse attended by perhaps 100 farmers and their families. At the beginning of the meeting, Smith passed out PEC applications. Only two of the farmers signed them. So Johnson tried his hand at persuasion. "He played on the emotions of the women," Smith says. "He talked about his mother, and how he had watched her hauling buckets of water from the river and rubbing her knuckles off on the scrub board. Electricity could help them pump their water and wash their clothes," he said. "When they got refrigerators, they would no longer have to start fresh every morning with the cooking. You'll look younger at 40 than your mother," he told them. Because he was the congressman, and to rural people, therefore an object almost of awe, and because he was very persuasive, they listened to him attentively, but they didn't sign up. On the 4th of July, 1938, he drove with Smith from picnic to picnic. Smith had brought along a Sears Roebuck catalog to show them the washing machines and refrigerators that they could use if they had electricity, but collected only a few handfuls of signed applications. In the car going to the next town, he, Johnson, would say, "What's the matter with these damn people? You offer them something." He'd get discouraged. Despite months of effort, the county agents had collected nowhere near the number required, not three per mile, but fewer than two. The Perdinalis Electric Co-op appeared stillborn. Johnson warned the farmers that if they didn't establish a cooperative to purchase the electricity created by the dams, TP&L might buy it and offer it only at rates they could never afford. In a speech entitled Our South, he said, "I believe we should use that power. I believe that river is yours, and the power it can generate belongs to you." "So," says one of the PEC's first directors, "we went back to Lyndon, the only man who could talk for us." He had tried to talk to the REA, going all the way up to the new administrator, John Carmody, but it had no luck. There was only one man left to talk to. Johnson asked Corcoran to get him in to see the president. In later years, Johnson told many stories, each different, of what he said to the president and what the president said to him when Corcoran finally, after considerable difficulty, obtained an audience for him. According to his story on one occasion, Roosevelt picked up the telephone while Johnson was still in the room, called Carmody and said, "John, I know you've got to have guidelines and rules, and I don't want to upset them, but you just go along with me. Just go ahead and approve this loan. Those folks will catch up to that density problem because they breed pretty fast." On September 27, 1938, a telegram arrived at the temporary Johnson City office of the Perdinalis Electric Cooperative. The REA, it said, had granted the PEC a loan of $1,322,000, shortly to be raised to $1,800,000, to build 1,830 miles of electric lines that would bring electricity to 2,892 Hill Country families. In so impoverished an area, the very existence of a large-scale and government-financed construction project was significant. The average wage in the Hill Country had been about $1 or $1.50 per day, but workers on government projects were paid the minimum wage in the area, 40 cents an hour or $3.20 per day. 300 men would be employed on the PEC project, but when Babe Smith arrived to open the PEC's first hiring office in Bertram, several times 300 men were standing in line to apply for these jobs. Many were given to men who had wanted electricity but had not been able to raise the $5 deposit. They paid it out of these wages. Herman Brown, Brown and Root had been given the contract to construct the PEC lines, was able to hire men who were known to be very hard workers. They needed to be. The poles that would carry the electrical lines had to be sunk in rock. Brown and Root's mechanical hole digger broke on the hard Hill Country rock. Every hole had to be dug mostly by hand. 8- or 10-man crews would pile into flatbed trucks, which also carried their lunch and water, in the morning and head out into the hills. Some trucks carried axemen to hack paths through the cedar. Others contained the hole diggers. The hole diggers were the strongest men, Babe Smith says. Every 300 or 400 feet, two would drop off and begin digging a hole by pounding the end of a crowbar into the limestone. After the hole reached a depth of 6 inches, half a stick of dynamite was exploded in it to loosen the rock below, but that too had to be dug out by hand. "Swinging crowbars up and down, that's hard labor," Babe Smith says. "That's back-breaking labor." But the hole diggers had incentive. For after the hole digging teams came the pole setters and pikemen, who in teams of three set the poles, 35-foot pine poles from East Texas, into the rock, and then the framers who attached the insulators, and then the stringers who strung the wires. And at the end of the day, the hole diggers could see the result of their work stretching out behind them, poles towering above the cedars, silvery lines against the sapphire sky. And the homes the wires were heading toward were their own homes. These workers, these were the men of the cooperative, Smith says. Gratitude was also a spur. Often the crews didn't have to eat the cold lunch they had brought. A woman would see men toiling toward her home to bring the lights, and when they arrived they would find that a table had been set for them, with the best plates and the very best food that the family could afford. 300 men, axemen, polemen, pikers, hole diggers, framers, were out in the Edwards Plateau, linking it to the rest of America, linking it to the 20th century, in fact, at the rate of about 12 miles per day. Still, with 1,800 miles of line to build, the job seemed, to families very eager for electricity, to be taking a very long time. After the lines had been extended to their farms and the farms were wired, they waited with wires hanging from the ceiling and bare bulbs at the end for the lines to be energized. It will not be long now until Mother can throw away the sad irons, the Blanco County News exulted. But month after month passed, for the lines could not be energized until the entire project was substantially completed. As the months passed, the Hill Country's suspicion of the government was aroused again. Brian Smith had persuaded many of his neighbors to sign up, and now, more than a year after they had paid their $5, and then more money to have their houses wired, his daughter Evelyn recalls that her neighbors decided they weren't really going to get it. She recalls that all their money was tied up in electric wiring, and their anger was directed at her family. Dropping in to see a friend one day, she was told by the friend's parents to leave. "You and your city ways, you can go home, and we don't care to see you again." They were all but ostracized by their neighbors. Even they themselves were beginning to doubt. It had been so long since the wiring was installed, Evelyn recalls, that they couldn't remember whether the switches were in the on or off position. But then one evening in November 1939, the Smiths were returning from Johnson City, where they had been attending a declamation contest. And as they neared their farmhouse, something was different. "Oh, my God," her mother said, "the house is on fire." But as they got closer, they saw the light wasn't fire. "No, Mama," Evelyn said, "the lights are on." They were on all over the Hill Country. And all over the Hill Country, Stella Glidden says, people began to name their kids for Lyndon Johnson. This concludes the reading of The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, Part 2, by Robert A. Caro. This book was read by Grover Gardner. Additional titles by Robert A. Caro in the Books on Tape Library include The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, Parts 1 and 3,